This is WGNS Action Line, talking with Rutherford County newsmakers about what matters most to you.
Your host, J. Paul Newman of the monthly District Attorney Show, will now take you on a journey to explore recent Rutherford County court cases, cold cases, and more.
The viewpoints and opinions expressed on this broadcast are the viewpoints and opinions of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the viewpoints and opinions of this show, its host, or the management of this station. You are listening to WGNS.
We welcome everyone to the program. My name is J. Paul Newman. My co-hosts are former District Attorney General William C. Weitzel, Jr., and current Rutherford County District Attorney Jennings Jones.
We thank WGNS for providing the airtime. And we also thank our producer, Scott Walker. Most of all, we thank you for listening.
In our Inside the Courts segment, Rutherford County District Attorney General Jennings Jones will inform you about recent grand jury, general sessions, and circuit court activity. Today, in our What's the Law segment, former District Attorney General Bill Weitzel will discuss cold case investigations with Sergeant Dan Goodwin of the Rutherford County Sheriff's Office. In our Call to Conviction segment, we will highlight the 1984 murder of MTSU student Laura Salmon. We will provide you with a behind-the-scenes look at the investigation and the trial that followed over 26 years later in August of 2006. We will also look at the important role that the Laura Salmon case has played in our criminal justice system. My two guests that will discuss the Laura Salmon case are Sergeant Dan Goodwin of the Rutherford County Sheriff's Office and forensic scientist and blood spatter expert Jerry Finley.
We will begin our broadcast after you listen to these important messages.
At Middle Tennessee Electric, we see the lines that link us all, illuminating our neighborhoods, empowering our businesses, and helping us to recharge. Because we believe in the power of good energy. Whether it comes from our grids, the sun, or a kind heart, and as your family and our region continue to grow, you can trust that we'll always be there for you. Middle Tennessee Electric, bringing good energy.
This is Inside the Courts. A look at this month's trials, pleas, and grand jury action. Inside the Courts is presented as a courtesy of the Rutherford County Clerk's Office.
Good morning, everyone. This is your District Attorney General, Jennings Jones, and today I will be your tour guide through this episode of Inside the Courts. We begin this segment by stating that none of the defendants named in upcoming trials or hearings have been convicted, and of course, they are presumed by our law to be innocent. With that as a prelude, we will now go inside the courts. On March 9th, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a 911 call for shots fired at a residence on East Vine Street in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Upon arrival, officers discovered Mr. Davion Gates lying unresponsive in the driveway of his residence, suffering from multiple gunshot wounds. Mr. Gates died from his injuries. Detective Justin Fugate with the Murfreesboro Police Department was assigned as the lead investigator. Multiple persons resided in the residence, and officers learned that the 23-year-old gunshot victim was a romantic partner of one of the residents, a 41-year-old female. Also at the residence was a 44-year-old Corey Munsell Lillard. Mr. Lillard is the father of several of the female residents' children. Mr. Lillard was also staying at the residence at the time of the shooting. Detective Fugate interviewed multiple witnesses, but also reviewed video jail calls between Mr. Lillard and one of his sons that was incarcerated at the Rutherford County Adult Detention Center. Mr. Lillard was on a video call with his son at the time of the shooting. From a review of this video, as well as evidence collected on the scene, Mr. Lillard was charged with first-degree murder, maintaining a dwelling with the purpose of selling or using narcotics, possession of a Schedule II drug with the intent to resell, possession of drug paraphernalia, and possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. A preliminary hearing was held on June 18th of this year before the General Sessions Court, and probable cause was found to bind the matter over for presentation to a Rutherford County grand jury. The defendant is represented by counsel, Mr. John Slager, and the state is represented by Assistant District Attorney Matt Westmoreland. On April 13th of this year, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a 911 call for shots fired on South Rutherford Boulevard in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Upon arrival, officers discovered the body of Mr. Paul Howell in the roadway. Mr. Howell had been shot in his throat and died as a result of his injuries. Detective Andrew Stallnacher was assigned as lead investigator. Also on scene was Mr. Brian Craig, a friend of Mr. Howell's. Mr. Craig had sustained a single gunshot to the arm. Witnesses to the shooting reported a road rage incident where Mr. Howell and Mr. Craig were nearly run off the road by an unknown driver. All parties came to a stop at a red light, and a verbal altercation led to shots being fired by the unknown driver. Almost 30 minutes after the incident was reported, Mr. Joseph R. Gann called 911 to report that he was the shooter. Mr. Gann was interviewed along with multiple witnesses. At the conclusion of the initial investigation, Mr. Gann was charged with second-degree murder, attempted second-degree murder, and reckless endangerment with a deadly weapon. Mr. Gann is represented by counsel, Mr. Josh Crane. The state is represented by Assistant District Attorneys Trevor Lynch and Matt Westmoreland. This matter has been bound over by agreement to be presented to a Rutherford County grand jury. On May 15th, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a 911 call of shots fired at a gas station on Joe B. Jackson Parkway in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Officers discovered the body of Mr. Devin Lawrence. Mr. Lawrence had been shot multiple times in the back and died from his injuries. Officers also located Mr. Eric Mitchell, Mr. Lawrence's brother. Mr. Mitchell had been shot once in the arm and beaten across the head, face, and body. Also on scene was Mr. Juan Charco and his brother. This altercation was captured on video surveillance. Detective William Pullius was assigned as the lead investigator. Upon conclusion of the detective's investigation, officers discovered that Mr. Charco and his brother were in the process of illegally transporting a vehicle that was owned by Mr. Lovitz from Atlanta, Georgia to Nashville, Tennessee, without Mr. Lovitz's knowledge or consent. Mr. Lovitz and his brother confronted Mr. Charco and his brother and took the vehicle back at gunpoint. When Mr. Lovitz and Mr. Mitchell were attempting to drive away in their own vehicles, Mr. Charco retrieved a semi-automatic rifle and shot over 25 times the two men. Mr. Charco has been charged with second-degree murder and attempted second-degree murder. This matter has been bound over by agreement and awaits presentation to a Rutherford County grand jury. The defendant is represented by counsel, Mr. Jeffrey Jackson, while the state will be represented by Assistant District Attorneys Trevor Lynch and Matt Westmoreland. On February the 15th of last year, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a 911 call of shots fired in an apartment complex on Puckett Creek Crossing. Officers discovered the body of Miss Rebecca Stockton on the floor of her apartment. Miss Stockton had been shot multiple times. Detective Julie Cox with the Murfreesboro Police Department was assigned as the lead investigator. Miss Stockton's live-in boyfriend, Salim Hamilton, was missing. A manhunt for Mr. Hamilton was ordered, and he was located in Corbin, Kentucky, where he was found to be in possession of the rental car of Miss Stockton and a .40-caliber semi-automatic handgun. Miss Stockton was shot and killed by a .40-caliber semi-automatic handgun. Mr. Hamilton was charged in Kentucky with possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. The Murfreesboro police charged him with first-degree murder and extradited him back to Tennessee from Corbin, Kentucky. A preliminary hearing was held on January the 4th of this year, and the General Sessions Court bound the case over for presentation to a Rutherford County grand jury, where the defendant was indicted for first-degree murder, tampering with evidence, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, and employing a firearm during the commission of a felony. The state will be represented by Assistant District Attorneys Trevor Lynch and Matt Westmoreland, while the defendant is represented by Mr. Chris Fisher. The last court date for this case was held yesterday, October the 30th. On July the 11th of 2022, officers with the Smyrna Police Department responded to a reported aggravated assault. Upon arrival, officers discovered that two brother-in-laws, Mr. Jason Munivong and Mr. Edgar Mercado, got into a verbal disagreement. At one point during the argument, Mr. Munivong pulled a firearm on Mr. Mercado and pointed it at him. According to witnesses, Mr. Mercado was unarmed and had not exhibited any aggressive behavior toward Mr. Munivong. Mr. Munivong was arrested for aggravated assault. In April of 2023, a Rutherford County grand jury indicted Mr. Munivong for aggravated assault, and on August 21st of this year, a jury of his peers convicted Mr. Munivong for aggravated assault. A sentencing hearing is scheduled for the end of this year. The defendant was represented by counsel Mr. Rob McKinney, while the state was represented by Assistant District Attorney Sarah Davis. A trial is scheduled to begin on January the 7th of next year on Mr. Chris Robinson and Mr. Chris White for the allegations of first-degree murder, aggravated burglary, especially aggravated robbery, especially aggravated kidnapping, employing a firearm during the commission of a dangerous felony, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, and tampering with evidence. Mr. White is represented by Mr. Paul Bruno, while Mr. Robinson is represented by Mr. Rob McKinney and Mr. Brian Lewis. The state will be represented by Assistant District Attorneys Trevor Lynch and Ashley Hall. A trial is scheduled to begin on February the 20th of next year on Apollo Cantrell for allegations of first-degree murder, aggravated assault, reckless endangerment, employing a firearm during the commission of a dangerous felony, and possession of a handgun by a convicted felon. The state will be represented by Trevor Lynch and Matt Westmoreland, while the defendant will be represented by Mr. David Clark. A trial is scheduled to begin on March 10th of next year on Dontorius and Donzala Hamler for second-degree murder, 2 counts of attempted second-degree murder, 6 counts of aggravated assault, employing a firearm during the commission of an offense, and reckless endangerment. Mr. Hamler is represented by counsel Mr. Ben Wetzel with the Public Defender's Office, and Ms. Hamler is represented by Ms. Jennifer Fiola. The state is represented by Assistant District Attorneys Matt Westmoreland and Trevor Lynch. A trial is scheduled to begin on April 21st of next year on Jeffrey Burris for an allegation of first-degree murder. The defendant is represented by Murfreesboro attorney Mr. Josh Crane, while the state is represented by attorneys Haley Ranieri and Trevor Lynch. A trial is scheduled to begin April 28th of next year on Dante Martin for allegations of first-degree murder, attempted first-degree murder, 2 counts of aggravated assault, reckless endangerment, carrying a weapon on school property, and employing a firearm during the commission of a dangerous felony. The defendant is represented by counsel Mr. Jacob Findlay, while the state will be represented by Assistant District Attorney Matt Westmoreland. And that will conclude today's look inside the courts.
When I eat healthy, I can eat at Demas's. When I want to eat unhealthy, I can eat at Demas's. If I'm in the mood for pasta, I go to Demas's. If I want steak, I go there. It does not matter what I'm in the mood for. This is Peter Demas. The only thing we don't have is fried food. So it's very easy when you want to take a group out and there's that veto power person who's like, I don't want this. Well, we usually will have something that they want because we have such variety on our menu. The only thing we don't have is fried food. Demas's Restaurant on Northwest Broad Street.
For all of our local bird enthusiasts, Animal City in Murfreesboro has everything you need to take care of your feathered friend. Hi, this is Amanda from Animal City. Come do business with my family. Whether it's parakeet, cockatiel, finch, or more, we have a variety of beautiful birds waiting to greet you, as well as the cages, toys, and high-quality food to keep them happy and healthy. We have it all. Come see why bird lovers flock to Animal City, 919 Northwest Broad Street in Murfreesboro.
The Action Line on FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro, FM 100.5 Smyrna. Listen and watch at WGNSradio.com.
Every homicide, every rape, every robbery affects the entire community. People who are victims of these crimes need closure. The people who committed these crimes must be held accountable. Law enforcement needs the community's help in seeking justice. Please listen as we review an unsolved mystery in this month's Cold Case Profile.
Today, in our Cold Case Profile segment, we will highlight three separate homicide cases. They are the murders of Cedric Herbert, William Greg Hawkins, and Nathan Morgan. I will be joined in that segment by Detective Sergeant James Abbott of the Murfreesboro Police Department and former District Attorney General and my former co-host of this program, William C. Weitzel, Jr.
Please listen as we review an unsolved mystery in this month's Cold Case Profile.
On June the 15th, 2009, at 9:17 a.m., the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a frantic call. The nature of the call was a possible burglary at an apartment complex on East Northfield Boulevard. When officers arrive at the scene, they see that the apartment door had been kicked open. Inside, they meet the lady who had called the police. She told officers that she lived in the apartment and that earlier that morning, present in the apartment were herself, her small child, and Cedric Herbert. At about 8 a.m., she left the apartment and took her child to daycare. She went on to say that when she returned, she discovered the body of Cedric Herbert. The police investigate. They determine that 24-year-old Cedric Herbert had been shot to death. Police now believe that someone or a group of individuals forced their way into the apartment and shot and killed Cedric Herbert. Robbery may have been the motive. According to family members, Cedric Herbert had a large sum of money on him the day before the murder. Why he was killed remains a mystery. His killer or killers remain at large. Detective James Abbott of the Murfreesboro Police Department has reopened the investigation. He is now asking for your help. We are pleased to have with us today in the WGNS studios, Detective James Abbott. Detective Abbott, I'm always very careful when releasing information on any pending investigation, so I always leave the minute details to the investigators. Can you fill in the details regarding how Mr. Herbert happened to be in the apartment on Northfield Avenue that day?
Well, Mr. Herbert and the young lady that lived at the apartment just started seeing each other, and that he'd come over earlier that morning, sometime around 2, 3 a.m. in the morning, to see her, and had fallen asleep on the couch. When she arrived home, she found him laying face down in the bedroom, suffering from multiple gunshots.
Tell us why you were taking another look into this case.
In these kind of investigations, you always kind of, especially on your cold cases, you go back, but as we like to sometimes say, we're past the CSI phase of these type of cases. Now it's getting these kind of cases out in front of the public and getting information from possible people that have heard things or people that may have known information but was afraid to come forward then. They may now be more willing to come forward.
Are there any class of witnesses who you'd like to talk to, such as friends, co-workers, or other persons that might help you fill in the blanks?
Yes, we'd like to speak with any friends of Mr. Herbert's, any associates of Mr. Herbert's, co-workers, anyone, family, anybody who may have information about this or information about his activities were and what he was doing up to about 48 hours to 72 hours prior to the homicide would be very helpful. Also, we'd like to speak with anyone who may have just heard what is sometimes called street talk. It would be great to hear from those folks that may have heard something from just someone who may have said, I heard this from someone who heard this from someone who heard this from someone.
I know that you're a very experienced cold case detective and have worked some very good cases. What efforts has law enforcement made to get this case in the public's eye and ask for the public's assistance in solving this crime?
Again, we're doing this show this morning, which is a great tool, especially the local level, to maybe try to get the information out. And we're also working with our public information officer using social media, and we're going to try to get this out on the social media sites as well.
What can you tell us about Cedric Herbert or the apartment complex or anything that might help a listener think, oh, I remember when that happened?
The apartment complex is over on East Northfield, and it is near the intersection of Highland and East Northfield. Mr. Herbert was a gentleman that lived here in Murfreesboro. He lived actually out on Bradable Pike area, but he resided a lot with this young lady from what we understand now when he first started seeing her there at the apartment. But Mr. Herbert would oftentimes be seen with friends over on Academy Street and also around Eagle Street. So people may remember Mr. Herbert from those areas as well, Mr. Cedric Herbert.
If anyone has information regarding who killed Cedric Herbert, who should they contact and what phone number should they call?
They should contact myself or any member of the Murfreesboro Police Department, but the Murfreesboro Police Department's Criminal Investigation Division. They can call me, Detective James Abbott. My number is 615-893-2717, or they can also call our local Crime Stoppers.
Detective Abbott, we want to thank you for being here today, and we want to thank you for the job that you do. On the morning of October the 16th, 2015, Brandy Hawkins and her father, Greg Hawkins, were fishing near the Mona boat ramp in Rutherford County, Tennessee. After a few hours on the water, they decide to head back to shore. Brandy remains in the boat while her father exits to walk back to get the trailer. Brandy Hawkins loses sight of her father as he walks away and into the parking lot. The time is about 11 o'clock a.m. It is then that Brandy Hawkins hears what she believes to be gunshots. She rushes to the parking lot, and there she finds her father. Greg Hawkins has been shot, and it appears his truck has been burglarized. Greg Hawkins dies that day. This case remains unsolved. Greg Hawkins was a valuable member of the community. He was an engineer at the Nissan plant in Smyrna, Tennessee. But he was more than that. Greg Hawkins was a devoted Christian. He was a husband, a father, and a brother. His family and friends have suffered a tremendous loss. We are asking for your help. Law enforcement and the Hawkins family wants to know why he was killed. And they want to know who killed him. A large reward has been offered in this case. If you have any information regarding the murder of 53-year-old Greg Hawkins, please call the Rutherford County Sheriff's Office at 615-898-7770. Or you can call Crime Stoppers at 615-893-STOP. Your call to Crime Stoppers is confidential. On May 22, 2010, Nathan Morgan Jr. was visiting friends at 1401 Eagle Street here in Murfreesboro. Just after midnight, shots were fired into the crowd that was gathered in the front yard. Three people were struck by the gunfire. Louis Sweeney of Nashville was treated at Middle Tennessee Medical Center for injuries to the neck and shoulder area. Byrus Hughes of Murfreesboro was also wounded and was treated and released at a local hospital. The third person shot was Nathan Morgan, Jr. Mr. Morgan was pronounced dead that night at Middle Tennessee Medical Center. Through the investigation, it was learned that one or more persons fired the shots from an outside area of the residence next door to 1401 Eagle Street. The weapon appears to have been a rifle, and multiple shots have been fired. Nathan Morgan, Jr. left behind a family that included his mother, his sister, and a daughter who misses him each and every day. Law enforcement and the family of Nathan Morgan, Jr. now ask for your help. Violent crimes will continue as long as good people remain silent. If you have any information regarding the murder of Nathan Morgan, Jr., asking for your help today is Detective James Abbott of the Murfreesboro Police Department. You can contact Detective Abbott by calling 893-2717, or you can call Crime Stoppers at 893-STOP. Detective Abbott, in listening to my presentation of the case summary, are there any facts that I need to correct or any facts that you would like to include for the public's consideration?
Based on the statements and information gathered and corroborating evidence that we have, we know that there are some other facts out there that we now know. One of these is being that we do have a person of interest who has been identified and has been identified through corroborating evidence and information and statements given by individuals. We know that there was a phone call or a series of phone calls made before the shooting and after the shooting. And we believe that these phone calls that the individual discussed the shooting, those are facts of the case that we need people to hear about and try to generate more leads and get those people who received those phone calls to come forward.
Can you describe cooperation of the public in general during this investigation?
We received cooperation from the public. We would not be to this little point now without that cooperation, knowing that there was these phone calls made and that pointed us into the direction we needed to obtain the evidence, corroborate all this information. We feel that these people probably, or someone has talked about what the conversations were to other people, and we're needing them to come forward.
Can you describe for us the cooperation you've received from the family during the investigation?
The family has been very supportive. They understand that this is a process. Sometimes it can be a long process, but at the same time, it's gone on too long, and they're wanting closure. I understand that and feel for a family who has to go through this. They've been very supportive. Anything that we've needed, any type of assistance, they do everything they can to help us. And they understand that, again, this is a long process, and they understand that sometimes our priorities are taken away on other more immediate cases. But again, they know that we will refocus back on this case. Ms. Pringle and me, myself, we discuss this case. We talk about it probably monthly, sometimes even weekly. So she'll call me, or if I have some new information, I will call her. And that's really good to have her still communicating, still staying in touch with us about the case.
Also, while I was preparing and going on the internet, it was quite easy, and I recommend for the listening audience, if they want more information, to go on the internet, and if you simply put Nathan Morgan Jr. in as a Google search, you'll come up with several articles that were published in the paper. You'll also find YouTube videos, and I saw one that where you were the featured person. Can you tell us how you set that up?
Yes, we did a reenactment, which is part of a Crime Stoppers commercial, which ran here in Rutherford County, which can still be seen on YouTube. And when we did the reenactment, we also held a press conference with some of the local TV media outlets here in the area. So we try to get that information out through the press conference, through you still have it on YouTube and other various outlets. Also, we periodically continue to talk to people in the community or in the neighborhood where this occurred, trying to get some information, trying to put it back out there in front of people, because we want to keep it out there in front of people. Because this is a case that we believe, based on information and evidence that we've already obtained, we believe that these phone calls were made. We just need to find those people that talked to this individual, or individuals that talked to these people, friend, family member, anybody who will come forward and talk to us. This is a case, I believe it is solvable. With the right one or two people that would come forward, this case could be, I believe, in front of a grand jury very quickly. So this is not just a case where we're just sitting here and we have no clue whatsoever. Like I said, it is a very solvable case, I feel, if the right people will come forward.
I believe General Weitzel may have a couple of questions for you.
Paul, you know this. James, I know you know. It's very important on these cases, as they get age on them, we want people to know that we don't forget about them. And as you mentioned, it is very important for the family to keep in touch, and also for us to keep in touch with the families. We've got somebody out there that's a murderer. And I know people are sometimes fearful. They're afraid if they give information or something that something may happen to them. And certainly I can understand that. But we need people to come forward and put a violent person behind bars. If this person is arrested and charged and convicted, everybody knows that. And hopefully it would make somebody think twice about taking a human life. And so it's dedication on the part of the police and the investigators, but it's also a dedication on the part of our citizens to be a part of the process, because without them, we cannot pursue, arrest, and prosecute these cases. And they're responsible just as much in a way as the police are for making their community a safer place. So I would certainly urge anyone with any information on this or other cases to come forward.
To announce that Capstar Bank is now officially a division of Old National Bank. All those friends you've made while banking here over the years, well, they're still there. And so are the delicious, warm, homemade cookies.
In Murfreesboro at 2230 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard.
Everything you enjoyed at Capstar, still there at Old National Bank. Old National Bank, ready to serve you.
Old National Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Hi, this is Tina Fox at your Rutherford Farmers Co-op. If you're looking for that unique Christmas gift, please come see us. We have everything you need for your holiday season. We have the clothing that will keep you warm from our Carhartt to your feet with our muck boots. We also have a great selection of fashion clothing for our ladies. And if you're looking for a unique gift, say for your patio, we also have our wonderful handmade wooden furniture. That's all here at the Co-op Farm and Home Center just off of South Church.
The Monthly District Attorney Show, heard the first Friday of each month, exclusively on News Radio WGNS. Your host, J. Paul Newman, will now take you on a journey to explore recent Rutherford County court cases, cold cases, and more.
We will highlight the case that is currently being prepared for broadcast on cable television. It is one of my most memorable trial cases. The case is the 1982 murder of Erastus Gene Stump.
From call to conviction, time now for a look back at one of the more intriguing and important cases for this community. From the crime, the investigation, to the prosecution.
On April 28, 1982, two fishermen discovered a partially decomposed body near the edge of Percy Priest Lake. Rutherford County Sheriff's Detective David Grisham arrived at the scene to find the decomposing body, but he found no skull. They did, however, locate skull fragments near the body. The body was checked for a wallet or identification, and neither was found. They did recover a list of names and telephone numbers in a pocket of the victim's jeans. The investigators also collected a lighter near the body, which bore the inscription, Gene. A shotgun wadding was also found in the area. Rutherford County Deputy Coroner Michael Carthen believed that the body had been there approximately 4 to 6 weeks. To assist in the investigation and identification of the body, Detective Grisham contacted Dr. William Bass, a forensic anthropologist with the University of Tennessee. After reconstructing the skull fragments, Dr. Bass determined that the victim died from a major gunshot wound to the skull. Dr. Bass determined that a shotgun was the likely weapon. Through the list of telephone numbers, the investigators contacted a friend of the victim, who was able to identify the victim's decomposing body. The identification was corroborated by the cigarette lighter inscribed with the name Gene. The body was identified to be the remains of Erastus Gene Stump. Although there were initially an infinite number of suspects in the victim's death, ultimately their investigation revealed that only one person had the motive to kill Gene Stump. On April 29, 1982, Deputy Pickle with the Rutherford County Sheriff's Office contacted that person, a person who was a friend and a co-worker of Gene Stump. That person was Randy McFarland. McFarland told police that he had last seen Gene Stump on March 29, 1982, at the Stump home. He said that Gene Stump arrived with some people in a van, and that Gene Stump had told him that he was leaving with the people in the van and going to Ohio. McFarland said that he never heard from Gene Stump again. No arrests were made, and the case remained unsolved for over 20 years. The case became a cold case. And now to discuss the investigation of the cold case and how it ultimately was solved, we welcome Major Bill Sharp and Dan Goodwin to the show.
Morning, Paul.
Morning.
Can you tell us how y'all first got involved in the investigation and what caused y'all to decide this is a case that we should work on?
When the unit first formed on July 1st of 2007, what we did was looked at all of the existing files of open unsolved homicides and other crimes that we had. It was about 14 to 15 at that point. And what we looked for were solvability factors. Bill had fiddled around briefly in 2001 with this case, and we already had a good idea that this was highly solvable because a lot of the groundwork that was laid back in 1982. In that interview with Pickle, one of the things that was discovered in 1982 was that after Gene left with the hippies in the van, that he'd filed an income tax return. McFarland had filed an income tax return, and it was mailed to his house, and he subsequently signed it and had his wife at the time pass it at the bank, thereby getting Gene's tax returns for 1981 and profiting in that way. His guns disappeared. The vehicle that Gene Stump owned was eventually given to his wife. But basically, that's the point it was at when we picked it up in 2007.
Let me ask you this. One of the reasons we have the program is to ask people for help in solving these crimes. How useful was it for you to go out and interview people who knew Gene Stump at the time but hadn't been interviewed in over 20 years?
You know, that when we start these cases or any investigation, it's important to locate the family members, ex-family members, and so forth. So locating McFarland's first wife was very important. She was able to give us details of the case. Although she was interviewed originally after the body was discovered, she did inform us that out of the situation in which she was in, that being married to McFarland, that she wasn't quite truthful with it. So, you know, she was able to expound on her original interview to give us more detail, which led us on to other ex-wives, neighbors, and friends of McFarland who were able to give us background on Randy.
So would it be safe to say that one person coming forward may create kind of a domino effect where one lead leads to another?
That's the best way to describe it, because that's usually what happens. Once you get that first person comfortable talking to you, giving you names, and then you go toward forward to the second person that they give you, it is a domino effect.
Can you tell us about y'all's interactions and interviews with the defendant in this case, Mr. Randy McFarland? Tell us a little bit about what he had been doing that you discovered over the 20 years that he was in society.
As Bill mentioned, after we spoke to his first wife, we determined from her that she'd stayed with him a number of more years. Her main goal, it was a horrible relationship. She was trying to get her sons almost to adult age before she could depart the relationship. She told us about a subsequent wife. We'd already had information about what turned out. We thought it was a second wife, but it turned out to be the third. As we began speaking, as the trail spread out through all the people whose lives he'd injured over the years, we found out that he actually had a second wife that no one had known about. We found that lady, and just like his first wife that we'd spoken to, he made multiple admissions to her as well. The third wife, he made over 200 admissions to, killing Gene Stump. He was with her from about 95 through 2006, I believe.
But you know, Paul, what we've found out when we work these cases is how they reinvent themselves and become something they weren't when they were younger and before these terrible crimes. We found McFarland in Virginia, Bristol, Virginia, as a electrical engineer. Now, this is a man who may have had a GED, but he passed himself off as an electrical engineer, living a different lifestyle, living something beyond what he was. So we find it intriguing that normally these suspects do reinvent themselves, and it's very, very interesting.
Concerning that and reinventing themselves, I noticed in prosecuting the case, General Weitzel both prosecuted that and had the honor of working with y'all on this case. Mr. McFarland had several names, did he not?
Yes, he changed his name legally twice after the murder. Once his first marriage dissolved, he married another lady. He did one new variation of his name, changed the spelling on the last name. It was L-I-N, like is normal around here in Middle Tennessee. He changed it to McFarlane, M-C-F-A-R-L-A-N-E, and then finally he morphed that into MacFarlane, M-A-C-F-A-R-L-A-N-E. He also changed his first name legally a couple of times there, too.
You know, although it's not necessary to actually prove motive in a trial, a jury always likes to know what the motive was. Were y'all able to determine the motive in this case?
Yes, sir. They worked together at Thompson Green Machinery, where they overhaul Caterpillar gear, and they were working in the paint shop together, and they were very much a part of the urban cowboy bar scene at that time. But besides getting drunk and chasing women, what they liked to do was use drugs, and then they would rob drug dealers. They would do armed robberies of gas stations and stores. They were partners in crime.
When you talk to Mr. McFarland, can you tell us about your interactions with him and what, if anything, he said regarding the murder of Mr. Stump?
Well, basically, he minimized his story, changed facts from what he told police in 1982. And truth be known, we actually went up there with an indictment for him in our pocket. And after he told us that set of lies, we arrested him.
And paraphrasing just a little bit here, is when we were interviewing McFarland, he just looked at us and said, "Prove it. You know, you never prove it." So, again, it's almost like a condescending attitude while speaking with us that he placed himself, you know, at a higher level than Dan and I. So It's a real arrogant attitude that he presented.
How many years passed between the time that this murder occurred and do you remember when y'all arrested him or brought him to justice?
He was arrested in 2008, so well over 20 years. Sorry, now, my math skills are weak.
Ultimately, he was convicted of first-degree murder and got a life sentence. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And during the trial, there was one interesting aspect that I'd like to involve, the movie Miller's Crossing. Can you tell us what role that particular movie played and how that was used at trial?
While McFarland was married to his third wife, he made her watch that film. It's a Coen Brothers film, the same people that did Raising Arizona and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, but it was an early crime film. And it contained scenes in there that are very much like the site where Gene Stump was murdered, and he made hundreds of admissions to her. The best prosecutorial team in the state of Tennessee and perhaps America was able to get that in at trial. And that became a subject for appeal, but the appellate court ruled that it was perfectly okay the way it was done.
Okay, as I understand it, the location where the body was ultimately discovered was, can you describe that location for us?
Yes, sir. It was near the end of South Lamar Road on what at the time was Corps of Engineer land that was open to the public, a narrow lane lined with trees, and that's just like a scene for the movie where the bad guy takes another bad guy out and kills him in the woods.
And so ultimately you showed the jury the scene from the movie mm-hmm. that was so similar to the scene where the body was found.
Yes, sir.
Anything else y'all would like to share with us about that particular case?
Not just this case, but all the cases, even the ones that have not been solved. And many of these incidents, the suspect in these, will give little bits of evidence or tidbits of the case to a significant other. And exactly in this case, he talked about taking the boots from the victim. That's something that only the killer would have known. So when we found a witness to discuss it, this case interview, she was able to tell us that he informed her. So again, to the audience out there, if someone confesses and talks about these cases and tells you something, come forward. That little bit can solve a case.
And I believe in this particular case, there were actually some friends of his that he had told that he had killed somebody. Is that correct?
He told a number of people besides his wife. One in particular who was one of our witnesses, was a kingpin in the, what they call the...
Cornbread Mafia.
Cornbread Mafia in Kentucky. A great deal of the time he spent after the murder was in the state of Kentucky, and he met this fellow and worked for him at a bar, and he wound up testifying for us. He'd never even left this county before, but he found some of the other things that McFarland had been involved in, and he was more than willing to testify about the murder admissions that he'd heard.
Well, I want to congratulate both of y'all on solving this cold case. Y'all have solved many of them. Y'all are a shining example of how detectives should work on the case and how to treat the victims and the victims' family. And we really appreciate y'all being here today.
If you missed any part of this program, it will be available shortly as a podcast on the WGNS website.
The Monthly District Attorney Show, heard exclusively on News Radio WGNS the first Friday of each month.
As we end our program today, we thank our two very special guests, and we thank WGNS for providing the airtime. Most of all, we thank you for listening. We leave by saying, a safe community is the responsibility of each and every one of us.
For my two co-hosts, Jennings Jones and Trevor Lynch,
this is Paul Newman, bidding all of you a safe and blessed day.
The District Attorney's Office thanks you for listening to today's program. If you have any information regarding criminal activity in our community, please contact one of our law enforcement agencies. The information presented on today's show is solely for informational benefit and not intended to be legal advice. You should always consult an attorney whenever you need or rely on legal advice. Rutherford County's most trusted name in news. Talk Radio WGNS, Murfreesboro.